And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscone. Falling achievement scores, the challenges of school choice, and drug testing for middle schoolers. Those are just some of the stories making headlines in Pennsylvania of late. So this hour, we go beyond those headlines to get a clearer picture of some of the issues plaguing Pennsylvania's schools. We'll hear from a New York Times sports reporter about why one school district is subjecting middle school students to drug tests for everything from soccer to the scrapbooking club. Is it drug prevention or a violation of civil liberties? We'll also hear from WHYY's education reporter, Benjamin Harold, about the challenges of navigating school choice in Pennsylvania through the eyes of one mom whose experience suggests that the reality has yet to live up to the vision. But we begin with the crackdown on cheating that some say has led to big drops in student achievement scores for the first time in 10 years. PSSA scores were down in Philadelphia and across the state last year, especially at schools that were already under investigation for cheating in the past. So what is behind the drop and what's being done to address it? Joining us to kick off our update on Pennsylvania schools is Kristen Graham, education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kristen, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
So put the scores in perspective for us that we saw from last year. How significant were the declines, both in Pennsylvania in general and Philadelphia in particular?
Sure. Well, when you look at the scores in Pennsylvania, they are down for the first time since the PSSAs began being given in 2002. Now, the drops itself are fairly small by the numbers. Math, for instance, the scores were 77.1 last year and 75.7 this year, similar small drop in reading. So it's not, a huge drop, but the fact that every year we've been making steady progress and this year we're down is significant.
And we're talking, when you say 75%, that means 75% of the students tested are performing at grade level.
Correct. 75% of the students tested in Pennsylvania are reading or doing math at grade level.
And now we've seen some precipitous drops, particularly at schools that already were under investigation.
Right. The numbers definitely vary from school to school. And in Philadelphia, for instance, there are 53 district schools and 3 charters that are under investigation for cheating. And in most of them, we saw pretty precipitous drops. 17 of those schools under investigation in Philly, for instance, had pass rates that were at least 30 percentage points lower. So that's
enormous.
Significant.
Enormous. How did this alleged cheating take shape? I mean, what was done to alter these test scores as far as investigators can tell?
Right. Well, the investigations aren't final, but, what we've heard, what my colleagues and I have heard anecdotally, there were teachers at 2 schools in Philadelphia who came forward to us and told us what happened. And it was everything from, administrators suggesting that teachers teachers have kids race answers and point to the correct answer, too. In some cases, folks said they saw administrators changing answers.
Oh.
In no case have we heard of students cheating. This is all adult interference that is alleged.
And Kristen, the fact is that the bar has been set high in terms of No Child Left Behind, the standards that are set for schools to meet, and there's a lot riding on these PSSA scores.
Absolutely. These are high stakes tests. Whether a school makes adequate yearly progress, hinges on these scores. And, if a school fails to make AYP for enough years, it could be, taken over, given to a charter. There are serious consequences and people's jobs ultimately, ride on these scores.
Yeah. So there's a lot of pressure for administrators,
Absolutely.
For teachers to at least be tempted to do something to try to present the best scores possible in these cases.
Sure. These are truly high stakes tests.
Yeah. And the stakes are getting higher, right?
Yes. Every year, every couple of years, the bar has been raised. This year, the bar was raised by 9%. Proficiency targets rose 9%, and they rise again next year. No Child Left Behind has the target of 100% of kids meeting state standards by 2014. And so some states have applied for waivers. About 30 states in the District of Columbia have applied for waivers to not have to meet that. They have some other forms of assessment to show that they're making progress. But Pennsylvania is not among the states that's applied for a waiver. So you know, if nothing changes, all kids will have to meet 100% proficiency by 2014.
Is there any rationale as to why Pennsylvania has not applied for an extension?
The Secretary of Education says, look, No Child Left Behind stands to be reauthorized pretty soon, and so, you know, he doesn't want to keep changing the targets. You know, other states have said, we just feel like this is unbearable and we're not going to get there, and we don't want our schools to focus on an unrealistic goal. You know, those who have applied for a waiver, they have to instead focus on the bottom 15% of students, and so they're doing that instead.
So, Kristen, I'm thinking about this. 2014, 100% of students are supposed to be performing at grade level. They're supposed to be proficient, and yet right here in Philadelphia, we're looking at rates of 50% or less performing at grade level right now, correct?
In math, it's 50% of kids performing at grade level, and in reading, it's under that. I think it's 42 or 43%.
Wow. So what is the Philadelphia School District saying about the fact that half of its students, fully half and sometimes more than half, are not performing in math and reading, and they've got 2 years to get to 100%.
Well, I mean, there are lots of critics of No Child Left Behind, and folks just feel like this is an unreasonable goal. You know, and Philadelphia has certainly said, you know, look, we know this is unacceptable. We have to make quick, you know, progress that's quicker. It's just a really tough place to be in.
Yeah. There have been those who have said, listen, this is not so much about cheating or the crackdown on cheating, these lower test scores that we're seeing. What about the massive budget cuts from Harrisburg and the effect that that has had on education? Is that a valid argument?
You know, there's definitely a lot of debate. There are folks who say that the state is putting too much emphasis on the cheating investigation. I don't think you can deny that $1 billion has been cut in education statewide in the past couple of years. And you know, in some schools more than others, you've seen the effects of that. Certainly Philadelphia has suffered a lot. They've lost a lot of staff, you know, bigger class sizes, things like that. So that's, I think, is definitely a factor. You know, Philadelphia is certainly, you know, acknowledging that. And in fact, the Philadelphia superintendent has asked folks to look into, you know, why the scores are down in Philadelphia. You know, was it cheating? Was it budget cuts? But also, because the standards got tougher this year, that's you know, you would expect fewer folks to meet the standard.
Although budget issues notwithstanding, it still sounds like there is powerful evidence that something was awry as far as the altering the scores goes.
It certainly looks that way, especially in the schools where, you know, the cheating investigations are active. Yeah. You know, in some cases, there was one school in Philadelphia where math scores dropped 70%. And the principal of that school said, you know, geez, I don't know why the scores are down, you know, that much, that dramatically.
Yeah. So the investigation is ongoing. There are still a number of schools that are being looked at as far as this is concerned.
There are 53 schools in Philadelphia School District schools. There are three Philadelphia charters, and there are also five districts that are still under investigation.
Yeah, what other parts of the state are we talking about that are being investigated?
The other districts are Harrisburg, Hazleton, Pittsburgh, Reading, and Scranton. There are also a number of charter schools in Philadelphia. It's Imhotep, Walter Palmer, Leadership Learning Partners, and Philadelphia Electrical and Technical.
And that's interesting in itself, because charter schools were formed as an alternative to some of the problems that we've seen in public education, and yet this scandal, if you will, does not apply just to the public schools, but now we've got some charter schools involved as well, supposedly.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it just shows that this is really a serious problem, not just in public schools, but everywhere.
And I think, Kristen, we have to talk about the Chester Community Charter School. That is one that has made some headlines recently. I know that some of your colleagues at the Inquirer have written about that, but it stands out in the sense that that was a school that was really touted as an example of why charter schools work, and there's also a connection to Governor Corbett there.
Sure. The founder of the charter school is I think the single largest donor to Governor Corbett's campaign. It had been Chester County Community Charter had Chester Community Charter had been under investigation. No charges were filed. That is, they couldn't, you know, find a specific instance. Still, you know, they feel like the statistical anomalies there couldn't be explained. Yeah. So, you know, they feel like something was going on there, but you know, they're going to continue to monitor the school.
And we should probably just take a moment to draw a distinction. to what extent are charter schools accountable? Are they accountable in the same ways that the public schools are, or what's
in the exact
difference?
Same way? They're public schools. The kids take the PSSAs. They have to meet the same standards. You know, there are some differences in how teachers. 75% of teachers must be certified, but there's some more leeway to have teachers who are not certified. Oh. Public schools can't do that.
So this kind of problem is not unique to Pennsylvania. I've been reading that in Atlanta, for instance, they went so far as to hire former prosecutors and really conduct a thorough investigation, and they're looking at potentially some criminal charges there. What about Pennsylvania? Is there any reason to believe that we might go that route, or what do you see as being a possible outcome from all this?
Well, in Pennsylvania, the investigations that are currently being conducted are for the PSSAs from 2009 through 2011. And the state has basically concluded that they won't be able to bring criminal charges because they didn't have the right regulations in place. However, going forward, improprieties are found, teachers and administrators will be subject to criminal penalties. Everyone, starting this year, 2012, had to sign an affidavit acknowledging that if tests are tampered with, that they could face criminal penalties. So what folks who may be culpable for 2009 to 2011 improprieties, the Secretary of Education has said more than 100 folks stand to be to get some kind of professional discipline. You know, they might lose their license. They might face, you know, district level punishment.
Yeah, is that a lengthy process?
I mean, it's a very lengthy process because all these folks are you know, represented by unions, and there's due process, and you know, so it could be years before we see folks lose their licenses if that happens.
What's the timetable, Kristen, as far as you know, for the completion of this investigation? Because there are so many schools, many different districts. What's the timetable for all this?
Well, by far, Philadelphia is the largest, you know, with 53 schools. There are just, you know, a few schools at the other districts that are really in the spotlight. You know, we hear that they hope to have most of the investigations wrapped up by December. But then, of course, you know, they'll have to go through the due process. So, you know, it'll be a long time.
Yeah. And meantime, PSSAs will be taken again. And
absolutely,
there will be more data to look at. I know the Philadelphia school superintendent, the new superintendent, has said, hey, we need to look at this over a period of years and see how these numbers trend.
Right. There's a lot more analysis. And, you know, frankly, statewide, it's important to note that there were schools who were under investigation. There were initially 110 districts and schools. And many of those were cleared. So the ones that are still under investigation are really the ones where they feel there are most serious allegations that couldn't be explained through any other means.
Well, it will give you and your colleagues at the Philadelphia Inquirer lots to write about in the months and years to come, for sure. Kristen, thank you for helping us to understand that. We are doing an update on Pennsylvania schools. There are a lot of stories that are making headlines about schools in Pennsylvania. Some good, others not so much. And when Radio Times comes back on WHYY, we're going to hear from Ben Harold, who is one of the reporters who broke the story of that alleged cheating scandal. And he writes for WHYY and for the Public School Notebook. Ben is standing by. He's going to help us explore the challenges of school choice when Radio Times comes right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to? Would you like to reduce your drinking? UPenn is conducting a 13-week research study of a medication to help people reduce their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and a regular drinker. The study provides a medical evaluation, including blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 241. 215-222-3200, extension 241.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company in residence at the University of Delaware, supports WHYY. The Rep offers the work and words of master storytellers and presents Connor McPherson's The Weir, now through October 14th. A few mates gather at a pub in Ireland for pints and a spooky story or two. When a pretty stranger joins them, her tale becomes the most eerie and unnerving of all. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscawain. This hour, we're taking a closer look at some of the headlines coming out of Pennsylvania schools in recent weeks. In addition to the reported drop in student achievement test scores and the ongoing investigation into possible cheating, there is also the debate over school choice. The idea has been around for a very long time, but for many parents and students, the reality has yet to catch up to the vision. WHYY education reporter Benjamin Harold has been writing about that and joins us now with a closer look at the challenges of school choice. Ben, welcome to Radio Times.
Good to be here, Tracy.
Well, it's great to have you with us. What are some of the factors that have made school choice, which seemed like a simple idea, so complex?
I think the place to start with, really, when talking about school choice is the emotion that parents have going through this process. There's really not much that gets parents, particularly in a place like Philadelphia, more stressed or more emotional than trying to find a good school that's a good fit for their child.
Yeah.
And I think the second thing to understand is that the reality is that Philadelphia already has an extensive school choice program in place. It's just really not a particularly well-organized one, and one that has really kind of emerged haphazardly over time as charter schools have expanded, as selective admission schools have expanded. And so what you see is that really it's a patchwork system that has no single set of rules or no single timeline, no single process. And that really contributes to this stress that parents feel trying to find a school for their child. So it really is very complicated, very messy, and then at the same time it gets caught up in these kind of highly politicized debate as well.
So it sounds like there's not really a clearinghouse for this information. Is the onus on parents to do the research and figure out where these schools are and what they teach and make those decisions for themselves?
Very much so. And I think if you talk to parents in Philadelphia, particularly young parents, you'll find that there's this dance that parents go through. And it starts with thinking about, where are you going to live? Are you going to live in the city? Or do you want to try and move to the suburbs? Do you think you can find a school in the city? If you are in the city, then it's okay. Well, what neighborhood are we going to live in? And there are certainly some very strong, well-regarded, traditional public schools, but often the neighborhoods around those schools are very hard to find. So the University of Pennsylvania, the vicinity around the university, for example, there's an elementary school called Penn Alexander that is extraordinarily popular. It's affiliated with the university, gets extra resources. And what we've seen is that in the 12 or 13 years that the school's been around, home prices in that region have escalated dramatically. So now parents have to pay a premium of up to $100,000 just to move in to that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And might not be guaranteed that they get a seat in the school because it's so popular.
Well, and that's the other thing, because when you look at the Philadelphia School District, certainly there's a lot of concern about the performance of the district as a whole. In fact, Kristen Graham and I were just talking about the fact that PSSAs indicate that something like 50% or fewer of Philadelphia School District students are performing at grade level in math and reading, according to those tests. So you look at the concerns about the quality of education within the Philadelphia School District, the greater incentive then that parents have to begin to look around at some of these other schools. But now there are other factors coming into the mix, the economic ones. Can we afford to even live in these schools? And the fact that the really good ones, like anything else, have waiting lists, right?
And I think what you find is that a lot of parents really have to become savvy consumers, and you need to devote an incredible amount of time and an incredible amount of resources to try and navigate this process. So the School District of Philadelphia has dozens of what you might call hidden gems around the neighborhood. So kind of neighborhood schools that might be in kind of a gritty neighborhood or might not kind of be on the public's radar screen, but they do very well. They have great teachers. They have high test scores. They have racially diverse student bodies. They have lots of great programming. And, you know, there's kind of a word-of-mouth network for finding those schools. You'll see parenting blogs hanging out at the playground, and, you know, people find out about them. But then, again, it's kind of, can I find a space in that school? And if I don't live in that neighborhood, there's a very complicated process for trying to transfer your child from your neighborhood school to another neighborhood school. And then that's, you know, not even getting into the charter school landscape, which, again, over the last 12 or 15 years in Philadelphia, we've seen just what some people have called a kind of a slow-motion stampede of parents looking for charter schools as an option. And, again, there's a tremendous variety. There's 89 charter schools in Philadelphia.
Wow.
Each essentially functions as its own school district. Some have different themes, different cultures, different focuses. So if you're a parent and you want to find a school that's going to be the best fit for your particular child, you might have to do an extraordinary amount of research.
Yeah, and a lot of parents are already, you know, working, and the research is a full-time job in itself, probably, for a lot of parents. But in the meantime, while they're doing that research, their children are at a school, probably, that they're unhappy with. And I have to believe that there's a lot of concern, there's a lot of fear in some cases about, gee, how fast can I get my child out of the school I'm not happy with and into a better school that hopefully will give them better opportunity down the road.
I spent the last month or so with a parent who lives in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. Her name is Karen Lewis, and she has an 8-year-old boy named Cooper, just a, you know, very sweet boy. I spent some time with him at the family, and he had this kind of elaborate Lego world that he had created on his coffee table, and, you know, very creative, very kind of introverted, and, you know, just a great boy. And he actually had attended one of these neighborhood gem schools, a school in Kensington called John Moffat Elementary that has high test scores and is generally very popular. His mom was very unhappy with the school. And once that happened, again, this emotion that parents go through, she just felt horrible. Every morning was a fight to get her son out the door. Mm. She felt that, you know, her personal experience was that she wasn't welcome at the school as a parent. She was displeased with some of the disciplinary procedures at the school. And it really kind of escalated over the time to the point where she felt that she was a bad mother for sending her child there.
Wow.
And it wasn't a widely shared experience, but it was a deeply held experience for her. And once, you know, parents start feeling those kinds of emotions, there's an incredible urgency to try to get your child somewhere where you feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
But, you know, she spent about 6 months really navigating this whole landscape, looking at Catholic schools, looking at charter schools, looking at private schools, trying to find another option. And it was a very trying process for her.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that process and some of the things that she discovered along the way. What are some of the things that she learned in doing that research and going through the process?
I think the first thing that was really kind of a hard for her, that was a challenge, was seeing that there's no single timeline for this, particularly when you start looking at the charter school world. Each school has its own application process. Some might be coming in the fall, some might be in the winter. And what we have also started to see is that a lot of the charter schools have wide variance in their application procedure. So charter schools are public schools. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to, by law, required to serve all students. But what we've seen is that some charter schools erect these kind of extraordinary barriers to prevent families from even applying. So mm-hmm. one school, and this was not a school that Ms. Lewis had applied to for her son, but one school called Greenwoods Charter in Northwest Philadelphia, they made their application available on one day a year. You had to physically attend an open house in order to get the application, and the open house was held at a suburban country club. So just by virtue of that, it really excluded a lot of parents from even having the opportunity to apply to get into the lottery for the school.
Yeah.
But even for, you know, for a lot of the schools that have more kind of acceptable application practices, there's a tremendous demand. Parents in Philadelphia have really latched down to charter schools as a good option,
mm-hmm.
and there's excess demand. There's a lot of waiting lists at schools. There's the lottery process for charter schools can be very trying for parents as well. You don't know if you're going to get a seat. Even if you find a school that you think your child would do well in, you're not guaranteed that you'd have a seat in there because there might be dozens or hundreds of other parents who feel the same way.
Yeah, and I don't want to give away the whole story, Ben, because I know that we'll be able to hear it tomorrow night, and it's something that you've been working on very recently, but in a sense, was she, at the end of that process, where did she find herself? Was she happy with the outcome? Did it raise more questions than answers? Excuse me.
Yeah, and again, I think often when we talk about school choice and we think about, you know, the kind of mechanisms of that, it's a very kind of political debate. And but the realities for parents like Karen is that it's kind of, it's very messy, and the lived experience is not necessarily the same as the politics of it. So school choice proponents will often say, What we really need to do is create more good school options and give parents more opportunity to choose, and that will really be empowering for parents. Yeah. But Karen, at the end of this process, kind of felt the opposite of empowered. Mm. She felt really bitter and kind of angry that she had to go through that. And so what you'll often hear from critics of school choice in other cities where it's very extensive, in New Orleans, for example, you'll hear parents say that, yes, there are some good school options, and yes, it is helping parents, and yes, we are creating some more good schools, but what you're also finding is that more parents are having to do more work to find a good school and often having to send their kids, including young children, on these extraordinarily lengthy commutes, and you know, and that there's questions about how well students with disabilities are being served in these kind of choice landscapes. And you know, there's a lot of questions like that as well.
Yeah, so there are great choices except when there are not, is what it sounds like, right?
And so the challenge really is making sure that there's great choices for everybody, and that they're accessible to everyone, including those parents who might not have a car, or might be working three jobs, or might have students with severe special needs. Yeah. And that's where the kind of rubber really hits the road with school choice.
Yeah. Well, and for a lot of these kids, the school of choice may not be anywhere near where they live, which sort of creates a whole other problem. And that's one of the issues that Michelle Rhee, for instance, in Washington, D.C., when she was the chancellor of schools there, was one of the big issues that, sure, there were a lot of great choices, but the accessibility was a whole other issue for a lot of parents, and they couldn't even get these kids to the schools, assuming they could get them in.
Right, and it's definitely a big challenge for parents. Again, not even just finding the right school and then getting your child into the right school, but then getting them to that school every day, because it might be far away or there might be other challenges.
Yeah.
But again, I think it's important to recognize that this is not something that may happen. There's already a lot of this happening in Philadelphia. Yeah. Already, the school district estimates that 3 out of every 5 high school students attends a school other than their neighborhood high school. That could be a charter school, it could be a magnet school, could be just going to a different part of the city for a different experience. And even at K-8, you know, for the younger children, about 3 out of every 10 students go outside of their neighborhood school. So there's already a lot of choice happening. The question, I think, is A, how can you make the process as it is fairer and simpler and less stressful for parents? And then you really start to get into the questions of, should we be expanding this and making this more prevalent while we're still trying to catch up with the realities of how it works already?
And why has it been that there isn't a more streamlined process? I mean, we've been at this for a while now. Why is it still so complex and so difficult to navigate for parents?
Well, I think that one of the kind of baseline frustrations and problems that has really generated a lot of the push for school choice is frustration with large bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And so with the School District of Philadelphia, there is a more or less single streamlined process that is more or less straightforward for, you know, applying to a school or getting into a school. It can be a challenge dealing with the bureaucracy because there's so many families and so many schools involved. But charter schools, really, the whole premise for charter schools was autonomy for accountability. Mm-hmm. And so what charters really want to be able to operate on their own terms and conditions and not have to interact with that bureaucracy, because they feel that bureaucracy is kind of part of the
problem.
And so there's a logic to that. But at the same time, now that you have 89 charter schools and you have 89 different applications and application processes and application timelines, it doesn't necessarily work real well for families. So resolving that tension is something that city leaders are really working on. And one of the things that is under discussion right now is coming up with a single application process for every school in Philadelphia. Yeah. There's some resistance to that, but I think that there is an emerging consensus that that's something that might be valuable for Philadelphia families.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the national landscape. You mentioned bureaucracy, and I'm just wondering, given the partisan politics that we've seen in Congress, are we likely to see any changes at the national level as it relates to school choice anytime soon? And what might a Romney presidency look like in terms of the school choice issue?
Well, I think that there is kind of an emerging consensus that is in some ways bipartisan for what Philadelphia is calling kind of a portfolio model, kind of accepting that charter schools are an integral part of the landscape and trying to really focus on coordinating multiple systems so that it works better for parents. And you hear that a lot in Philadelphia. Mayor Nutter has been a very strong proponent of that, and he's also been pushing for that with the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And others are kind of signing on for that idea as well. And so, again, the idea would be that you have multiple sectors of schools. You have the traditional public school system. You have charter schools. You have archdiocesan schools. But that for parents' sake, you really need to coordinate those better and make sure that there's good options in every community.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, some people have questions about that. But it does seem to be, you know, among, you know, with Philadelphia as a heavily Democratic city, for example, that that is the consensus among the leadership here. And I think Philadelphia is not unique in that way. Where there is some tension, and I think that can be more partisan, is around things like vouchers.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania recently passed a voucher-like program. It's not technically vouchers, but it functions in much the same way. It's an opportunity scholarship program that's really just getting off the ground now. But, you know, I think we see Republican leaders in the legislature and in the governor's office really strongly supporting that notion. If there were a Romney presidency, for example, I suspect that there might be a stronger push for those kinds of efforts as well.
Well, and voucher became a dirty word at some point in this process. And isn't it interesting, Ben, that many liberals who you would think would be very much in favor of, you know, school choice and all of these kinds of options really have not held that view, where it's, and instead it's been conservatives who have really pushed the choice issue and the voucher issue in particular.
I think one of the concerns with voucher programs in particular is that public education is just that. It's public, and it's there's a legal mandate and kind of a public trust that there will be free, quality, accessible public education for all. Mm-hmm. And I think the concern with voucher programs is that while it may work well for some students and families, it's not going to work well for all students and families.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's where you see kind of the split or the critique around vouchers.
Yeah. Also, Ben, just shifting back to Philadelphia, I was reading that next year it may become even more difficult at the high school level. There is talk about closing some additional high schools, doing some consolidations. And so now you've got parents who may already feel a little bit overwhelmed and stressed about these kinds of choices, maybe having fewer choices going forward, at least at the high school level.
What we're seeing is that as part of its what they're calling their facilities master plan, the School District of Philadelphia is anticipating closing as many as 30, 40, even 50 school buildings for next fall.
Wow.
Many of those are likely to be high schools. So just this month, they've begun a series of public forums where they're seeking input on, okay, how do we choose which schools to close in order that, you know, we're not totally disrupting the families all across the city, although I think that's inevitable in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so during these forums, we hear school district officials coming out and asking parents, how important is it to you to have a quality neighborhood high school? Would you rather have a neighborhood school that you can walk to, or would you rather have a number of quality options to choose from that might not be not necessarily be walkable? And it's a tough choice for families, and I think many parents and community members might not like being forced into that choice, but because of what the district has concluded are the financial realities associated with its surplus capacity in its buildings, there are going to be these big changes, and those are the types of questions that families and communities and school district officials are going to have to wrestle with.
Yeah. Ben, in our last couple of minutes here, tell us what else you're working on. What are some of the trends, some of the things that we should be watching for as we look at what's happening, particularly in the Philadelphia School District, but in Pennsylvania schools? What should we be watching for in the weeks to come?
I think the charter schools are really a big part of what's happening both locally and across the state. Again, it's both in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, charter schools are a big, significant part of the education landscape that parents are very attracted to. But there are a lot of concerns about accountability. There are a lot of concerns about accessibility. And mm-hmm. So locally here in Philadelphia, there's a big push underway to try and figure out, again, how can we hold charter schools more accountable for accepting all students? How can we hold them more accountable for their financial practices? How can we make sure that there are good decisions being made about which charters should be allowed to continue?
Yeah.
And then at the state level, there is a number of bills that are going to be up for consideration this fall that could really impact the charter school landscape considerably. There might be the opportunity for there to be a second entity that could create new charter schools. Right now, the School District of Philadelphia gets to authorize new charter schools, as do most individual districts. But those kinds of questions are going to be very big in Harrisburg this year.
Well, there will be a lot to talk about and a lot for you to write about as well, Ben. And by the way, you can hear the full story of Karen Lewis, that is the single mom we were just talking about, tomorrow evening at 6 on WHYY's Newsworks Tonight. You can also read more about school choice in Philadelphia in the latest edition of the Public School Notebook online at thenotebook.org. And up next, should middle schoolers have to undergo drug testing to join the Scrapbooking Club? A closer look at a controversial policy when Radio Times comes right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association announces the 6th annual Cape May Wine Festival, October 6th and 7th from noon until 5 p.m. Held at the Cape May Lewis Ferry Terminal, the event will take place outdoors on the Delaware Bay waterfront. Attendees can sample wines from 24 New Jersey wineries. Other festival features include food, crafts, live music, and a kids zone. More information at newjerseywines.com. The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY.
1.3 million women will experience domestic violence this year, and most of them will not report it. Violence not only affects the victims, it affects the children who bear witness. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, the trauma of domestic violence. We'll hear from professionals who treat both perpetrators and victims, and we'll hear from survivors. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Temple University Library support WHYY and present lectures exploring the American idea. The series begins October 2nd with a conversation on sports and race featuring Larry Lester, a co-founder of the Negro League Museum, and Rebecca Alpert, author of Out of Left Field, Jews and Black Baseball. Other programs discuss art collecting, noir as an American genre, and more. These are open to the public with no ticket required. Complete schedule online at library.temple.edu.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moskowain. We've been talking about what's going on in Pennsylvania schools of late. PSSA scores dropping and the ongoing investigation into schools accused of cheating. And school choice, why for many parents and their children there doesn't seem to be much choice at all. We turn now to a trend that has raised eyebrows in school districts in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. And that is drug testing for middle schoolers and not just for student athletes. In a number of school districts, urine samples are required whether you want to swing a baseball bat or sing in the choir. And some say the tests are a deterrent, but others call them a civil rights violation. New York Times sports reporter Mary Pallon has been writing about these middle school drug tests and other issues and joins us now with more on that debate. Mary, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've written about this school district in Milford, Pennsylvania, which, as I understand it, is kind of right on the line of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, New York. What happened there, and what's the status?
Exactly. So a few years ago, they instituted a random drug testing policy for students who participated in school sports or extracurricular activities. So the idea being, if you want to just come to math class, you don't have to do a drug test, but if you want to do voluntary activities, you do. It's been around for several years. This family filed a lawsuit and kind of through the legal pipeline did win an injunction that stops the drug testing, not just for their children, but for others in the school district. So right now it's kind of in a holding pattern as we wait for the lawsuit to shake out.
Yeah. So what was the parents' issue? What was it that caused them to go to the point of saying, it's time to file suit about this?
Well, their daughters aren't just student-athletes, but they also do extracurriculars. In the lead of the story, we talk about how this notification of drug testing came when one of the daughters wanted to join scrapbooking club. So they, you know, didn't really see the connection, and they also I talked to a lot of parents about this, and a lot of them argued that the kids doing extracurriculars aren't the kids that you need to drug test because they're the ones who are engaged after school, who are, you know, very busy and tend to have better grades, but they also saw it as a violation of their right to privacy. The districts that I've talked to that have implemented these policies see them as a measure to, you know, give kids an excuse to say no as a deterrent and as a broader safety concern.
Let me just pause for a moment, Mary, and invite our listeners to join us. We have had so much to talk about this morning that we haven't had much opportunity to squeeze in calls, but I do just quickly want to give the number, which is 888-477-9499. We've been talking about issues surrounding schools, and in this particular segment of the program, we are talking about drug testing for middle schoolers. Mary, there certainly has been an outcry just about the fact that we're talking about middle schoolers. We're talking about seventh graders and maybe sixth graders, depending on how some of the middle schools are situated. And my sense is that that's really the issue, that why are we, you know, reaching down into the middle schools and subjecting kids to this at this age?
Right. Well, the history of it is kind of interesting. As best as I could tell, no one really tracks how many middle schools are doing this. I kind of patched together a few states that I had talked to where it was happening. Sometimes it's just one county. Sometimes it's just one school. But high school drug testing has been around for a while, and there's at least three states where the entire athletic league is doing it, and then, like I said, you know, some counties will pick it up. And so what I found are the middle schools that were doing it, they're usually in districts where it's 7 through 12. So we'll start with a high school program, and then because of just how the structure of school boards or counties or whatever it may be are structured, they will add the 7th and 8th graders, occasionally 6th graders. I only found a few schools where that was happening. So it was always kind of in tandem with a high school program. I've yet to find, and maybe it's out there, but a county that was just testing middle schoolers and not the high schoolers as well.
So was there outcry from the very beginning with this, Mary? I mean, we hear the story about Milford, but this, as you pointed out, has been going on for a while and in various locations.
Right. Well, you know, there's kind of degrees of outcry, right? There's parents who kind of quietly mutter, and then there's a lawsuit and a lot of in between. And I spoke to several parents who were in favor of it. In fact, one of the districts we quote in the story, their superintendent said that, you know, parents requested it. They were worried about drugs, and they thought that the testing would be a good policy. So it was interesting. My inbox after the story ran was 50-50 on how people felt about this. The Learning Network has a blog post up that has 319 comments on our site about it, from many of which are from students. And it's a fascinating issue because people are really all over the place. So, yes, I think there has been outcry as long as the policy's been around. But with that, there's also been supporters.
Right. So the idea with the supporters is, hey, this is a deterrent. This is a disincentive for kids to even start down that road.
Right. So it gives kids, if you will, a talking point. If you're offered drugs, the thinking goes that they can say, hey, you know, I'm on the soccer team. I could get tested. I could get busted. And I think we have to be really careful when we say drug testing, too. There's two different kinds, right? There's drug testing for street drugs, marijuana, ecstasy, cocaine, things like that. And then there's drug testing for steroids, and that's a whole other swath. You know, performance-enhancing drugs, and I have yet to find a high school or middle school program where what they're doing on the performance-enhancing side even compares to what, like, say, an Olympian would go through, and that's a battery of tests. It's hundreds of tests. It's much more expensive. And this is another point of debate, is that a lot of people have argued, well, middle school and high school kids are more sophisticated than ever. They can get their hands on anything they want. If they're really going to do any kind of drug, they're going to find a way. You know, is the testing keeping up with that? I don't know. Like I said, there's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah. Well, and there's the financial layer, too, that I want to talk about, because there's got to be some money at stake in all of this. Tell us about that side of it. Are drug companies going and actively marketing to these school districts saying, hey, you need to do this to make sure that, you know, to be a deterrent for your students, to make sure that you don't have the drug problems that you could have otherwise?
Sure. It is, you know, I know it's a tough time for school budgets, and per school, we're not talking about anything really, really huge, but it is a few thousand dollars, which, depending on, you know, a school district size, can really make or break a budget. A lot of the companies, there's a few big players that are doing this, but a lot of it are the same companies that do employee drug testing, and I found a great number of school districts that were using whatever that company was locally, and for student privacy reasons, you know, they're not monitored the way, say, an Olympian would be when giving the sample, and a lot of doctors I talked to kind of raised issue with, you know, who's getting paid and the efficiency of such tests. So, for example, with the Olympians, being able to see the, you know, specimen being delivered, how it's handled, everything is a fodder for a lawsuit if it's not handled properly. At the middle school level, it's a little more informal in terms of the testing protocol. Again, the thinking being that these, you know, aren't going to be as sophisticated samples, but still, the schools are sometimes approached by companies, but often the schools seek them out, or they hear about other counties doing it. I talked to one person at a company who said schools don't want to be the first to do a policy, but they also don't want to be a last.
Yeah.
And in 2008, you know, with the financial decline, obviously a lot of schools pulled their programs, but what was interesting is that I talked to a lot of people who are in this business who said, well, now those people who curbed their programs or maybe did fewer tests per year or tested for fewer drugs, the more drugs you add, generally the more expensive it is per test, are starting to kind of dip the toe into these waters again and examine whether or not it's going to be worth their money.
So is it mainly marijuana that they're testing for, Mary, or what are they looking at primarily?
Right. I mean, I've yet to find an example of a middle schooler who's tested for performance-enhancing drugs, and we know about it. For privacy reasons, again, you know, usually law enforcement is not notified of a positive. Parents and guardians are. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but usually the positives, how rare they are typically marijuana.
So, which kind of leads me to the question, how effective then has the testing been? Is there reason to believe that, you know, because there have not been a lot of positives, that, hey, maybe the testing is working as a deterrent? Is it that the tests are not so effective? What can we make of that?
That's a really great question. I think people, even at the collegiate level, are asking these questions, where there's been drug testing since the mid-80s. Drug testing for high school students has been only around since, well, it's been around for a while, but a 1995 U.S. Supreme Court ruling is really what paved the way. We talked to, for our story, Dr. Lynn Goldberg, who's the Health of Division and Health Promotion in Sports Medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University, and it's funny because Oregon has actually had the high school that was in that 1995 Supreme Court case. And he did a study looking at, you know, whether the high schools that had programs saw kids using less or not. And he found that there was little evidence that they do work. Again, that is, you know, one study. There's a few others out there. But again, it's only been, you know, 20 years or so. So we're still learning whether it works or not. And, a lot of people made comparisons to DARE, which is a, you know, federal program that did drug education, I believe, in the late 90s, curbed because they couldn't find evidence it was effective. It's a puzzle, whether kids in middle school listen more to parents or teachers or their peers. It's tough. And he only studied student-athletes, by the way, so that, I think, is an important distinction, too, because typically, we've, you know, had this adage that they are going to be less likely to use. They have a sense of community. They have, you know, maybe mentors in their lives. But he couldn't find a difference.
And so I think I heard you say that if a student does test positive, parents are notified. And what else happens from that point?
Sure. Now, this varies greatly by school, and schools usually set up their own policies, but typically what happens is the student and the parent and guardian are notified. Sometimes there's a counseling program tied to that. Some schools have a two-strikes or a three-strike system. The law enforcement generally isn't notified unless the student is actually under the influence at the moment or has drugs, you know, in their possession. The idea for most of the schools that I talk to is to really target the kids who need help and try to get them resources. But again, you know, it's a random drug test, so there are very, very, very few positives relative to, you know, anecdotally what a lot of school nurses I talk to said they hear about in terms of drug use. So.
Yeah.
It really varies, but the idea isn't to yank a kid out of school forever and, you know, banish them. It's to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. So, and speaking of pulling kids out of school, is that how this works? I mean, do they just pull kids out of class and hand them a cup and say, it's your turn, or how do they do this testing?
Basically, a lot of students I talked to said that, you know, you kind of quietly get pulled aside. They try to, you know, keep it as quiet and low-key as possible, but sometimes, I mean, middle school is, as we perhaps can remember,
quiet and low-key, don't describe middle school.
Yeah, exactly. So five kids get pulled, and they're athletes. You know, usually kids know what's going on. They try to make it take place in a place that's, you know, confidential, so a kid can go into a nurse's office or somewhere that is tamper-proof. Quite honestly, the problem a lot of schools have had is, you know, if kids just don't have to go to the bathroom, that takes time, the logistics of it. I was surprised at how little tampering, when I talked to people about, you know, did kids try to game the system or not, and they said, you know, no, it's more often kids just don't want to go.
Just the practical,
you know,
stuff,
they don't,
right?
Really know what's going on. Right.
Mary, I've also been reading in preparing to talk with you about suspicion-based testing, and how common is that? You know, a teacher or a parent, I guess, or someone in an authority position suspects that there's an issue. Is that going on a lot, where they say, hey, I think there's a problem with this kid, I think this is somebody who needs to be tested, regardless of their activity level?
I haven't heard as much about that at the middle or high school level. Where that has kind of some precedent is at the collegiate level, when student-athletes join an NCAA school and they, you know, sign a bunch of paperwork saying what that means. Part of that is usually that a coach at the collegiate level, you know, has that right, and student athletes are, you know, made aware of that. I haven't seen that as much at middle or high school. It doesn't mean it's not going on. It doesn't mean it's not out there. But it's just so rare, and they really, the folks I talk to really emphasize the random nature of it. So I haven't seen that, but like I said, that doesn't mean it's not happening.
Yeah. So circling back then to Milford, do you have any sense in talking with people about what's going on there, talking about that lawsuit, about which way things might ultimately go?
Right. It's really hard to say, but there was a similar-ish a group of cases in California where they challenged not just the drug testing, but the drug testing for extracurriculars. I believe one of the cases there, it was a few years ago, centered around banned students, and they felt like, you know, we won't even bother with the student-athlete Supreme Court case piece, but we do question whether it's necessary for extracurricular activities. What helped those attorneys a lot, and they ultimately prevailed, was that California as a state has stricter privacy laws than what's at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I think that the attorneys who are looking at the Pennsylvania cases are hoping that that ends up being the case there, too. There was a case a few years ago in Pennsylvania as well, but the girls grew up. They ended up in college, so I think it was ultimately just kind of pulled aside. So we haven't really seen this litigated all the way through quite yet. Mm-hmm. The Kadera daughters are younger. They're in high school now, so we have to see how it all kind of goes through.
Yeah, and these are the girls in Milford that you just mentioned, right?
Exactly.
Who are at the center of this lawsuit. And I guess some of this will depend on the outcome of that suit, but is this a trend that you see picking up steam, Mary, in other school districts and other parts of the country?
That's a great question. You know, steroids in sports are a funny thing because it seems like every few, it's kind of a prevalent issue. It's always there. People always are talking about it. But, you know, we just had the Lance Armstrong case, which has reignited the kind of national conversation about this, and the Olympics, it's like every 4 years or every 2 years if you're a Winter Olympic buff, these things come up. So it's, again, it's hard to say. What's pushing this time around, I would say, is the school budget issue, that budgets are just so lean that I think that the school districts that are going to be pursuing it really have to be aggressive about it if they're going to do it. I actually talked to one a mayor in Alabama who their local school district was facing cuts to their program, and he actually used some of the city budget because he believed in the program so much. Mm. So I think that the financing of it is almost going to be a little more tricky. And again, we don't track it. The Department of Education doesn't track how many middle schools are doing it. So figuring out which wave which way the wave is going is going to be hard. But yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a lot more chatter about it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly an interesting topic, and I think one that certainly has gathered a lot of attention, and one that people like you will continue to be writing about and talking about as this lawsuit proceeds. Mary Pilon, thank you so much for being with us. We so enjoyed having you. Mary is a sports writer for the New York Times. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. And very shortly, stick around, because we'll be talking with Wyclef Jean about his new book, Purpose, An Immigrant Story. It is a fascinating account of his life, and he joins us next on Radio Times.